Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by Dynamics Productions with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, a roadmap for improving public education, an Eastern Kentuckian out there gathering ideas and solutions from other community-minded bright minds from all around the world. The first in a new feature about things you need to know when out in the great outdoors, and a conversation with a Kentucky photographer bringing home images of artists all around the Great Lakes region. First, President Trump justifies his immigration policies with the claim that undocumented immigrants are bringing waves of crime into the United States. Is there a connection between undocumented immigrants and crime? Anna Flagg has pursued that question in her role as senior data reporter for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit organization focused on criminal justice. Armed with a master's in human-computer interaction from the University of British Columbia, Anna has covered NSA surveillance, campaign finance, military spending, and the environment. And she joins us from New York. Thanks for being here, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
So I read your article in the Investigative Reporters and Editors Journal. I was drawn to it by the very provocative title, which is actually a question. It is there a connection between undocumented immigrants and crime rates? And before we get into your findings, going into your study, did you have any preconceived ideas about what the numbers might show?
Well, I didn't know what the data was going to show. I did know that there had been a lot of conversation about immigrants and particularly undocumented immigrants and just a lot of discussion about whether immigrants bring crime into the United States, whether directly by committing more crimes themselves or indirectly by causing pressures on the local environment, such as job competition, things like that. And I just had heard a lot of discussion about that, and I was interested to see, okay, what data is out there and what can the data tell us about crime and immigration, particularly undocumented immigration?
Well, I would have to think that gathering data about undocumented immigrants is pretty challenging. Of course, there's no exact count of unauthorized immigrants in the U.S., just educated guesses out there, estimates. What estimate did you use in your study?
Right, that's correct. There's no exact count. But thanks to this new data release by the Pew Research Center, we were able to get pretty good estimates of undocumented populations broken down by metropolitan statistical area across the country. And they released those estimates for 2007 and 2016, a few weeks before we did our report, and we were just very excited to see that because for the first time, we could look at how those populations have changed at sort of a city level in the last decade or so.
Okay, and you mentioned Pew. Any other resources that you turned to document these rates?
Well, we looked at the Uniform Crime Reporting Program from the FBI in order to get the crime rates data that we used in our analysis. So this project was sort of a combination of those two data sets, the Pew undocumented population and the FBI UCR crime data.
Okay, let's get into the study. And the first thing that fascinates me, and contrary to popular claims out there, your analysis found that areas with more unauthorized migration actually have larger drops in crime rates. Were you able to figure out why?
Well, the data shows us what happened. It doesn't explain exactly why. And I will say that our result, I think our result was more that undocumented immigration appears to have no relationship to crime. There did appear to be a slight decrease in areas that had more unauthorized immigration, but it was slight. And so it's kind of, it's unclear, how much that really means. So the result that I have been saying is that undocumented immigration does not increase crime. And if anything, it may actually lower crime.
Breaking it down, when you divide violent crime into the categories of aggravated assault, robbery and murder, and property crime broken down to burglary and larceny, do you see connections to undocumented populations there?
There's no connection for any of the component crime as well. So, you know, as you mentioned, we looked at overall violent crime, we looked at overall property crime, and then we broke each of those down into their component parts of assault, robbery, murder, burglary, and larceny, just to see, is there any effect of undocumented immigration on the overall rates of crime or any particular type of crime? And we found the exact same result for every type of crime, which is that there is no effect on crime.
So how do the results of your analysis compare with other studies on the relationship between undocumented immigration and crime?
These results are pretty consistent with the existing research and the data that we know about undocumented immigration. So it's been shown that undocumented immigrants commit crimes at lower rates than the native-born population. We also know that they are less likely to be incarcerated than the native-born population. We've seen that on a state level, undocumented immigration does not increase violent crime. And in our kind of latest analysis, what we're doing is narrowing it down to a more local level, which is the level of a city and its surrounding parts or a metropolitan statistical area, and showing that when undocumented immigrants move to an area, they do not increase the crime rates.
How many MSAs are you looking at?
There was about 180 MSAs that were documented in the Pew release, so that's what we looked at.
Okay, and you report that your preliminary findings indicate that other socioeconomic factors predict higher rates of different types of crime, while undocumented immigration populations don't. What are those indicators for higher crime rates?
That part of the article was some of the preliminary interviews that we had done with some academic researchers that are working on similar research right now. And they have not published that study yet, but they're a good way into their research and they're finding some initial findings. And so what they told me is that their analysis suggests that things like unemployment rates, housing instability, and other sorts of measures of economic hardship will all predict higher rates of different types of crime, and undocumented immigrant populations are not associated with that.
So, Anna, after you've had time to digest and to process the information that you discovered in your analysis, what's your conclusion about undocumented immigrants and crime in America?
Well, my conclusion is that undocumented immigrants do not increase crime in America. And, you know, I guess what I would say, looking at the rhetoric that we hear about immigrant criminality and all these kind of faulty ideas that immigration increases crime, is that, you know, we all want crime to go down, right? But to do that, we need to be investing in evidence-based crime prevention strategies that actually have a chance of working. And cracking down on immigration or undocumented immigration is not going to do that.
Anna Flagg, she's senior data reporter for the Marshall Project in New York, and we thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Up next,
the trend data really demonstrates our expertise at preparing people to be creative, to be problem solvers, to be hard workers, and to go somewhere else and help that community improve.
Jeff Hawkins, director of the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative, on his organization's strategy for a change of direction in Eastern Kentucky education.
What we want to do is flip that script and reverse it so that the brain drain is no longer ongoing, but to be able to create a diversity of employment opportunities where we are and take advantage of the assets that we have.
Hawkins is joined in the studio by Magoffin County Schools Superintendent Scott Helton. They have a plan and a call to action for the improvement of public education in Kentucky, and they're here to share the details. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It could be featured in a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The superintendents of 22 Eastern Kentucky school districts have a new strategy for public education. It was developed with the support of the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative, whose director, Jeff Hawkins, and chair, McGoffin County Public Schools Superintendent Scott Helton, are here with the details, and we welcome you to Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Scott Helton, is it difficult to get people to wrap their heads around this link between education and economic development?
It is. The obvious thing that you look at with good school systems in communities, you tend to more be able to attract more businesses and more companies to come in. With a poor school system with a declining enrollment, you send off a negative vibe that something must be wrong. In reality, without a good school system, we can't sell our communities. We can't sell our students' work ethics or our community's work ethics or anything like that. And what I've been trying to do lately is to show and get out the word of what we're doing in our schools and how we're wanting to improve within our community the image of our schools.
The report includes a section, The Way Forward. And I've referred to it as a roadmap. It seems as one to me, one that policymakers can refer to generate a strategy for the future. And it is loaded with regional demographics, with trend data, and by the way, can be found online at theholler.org if you want to see the whole thing. But this information taken on the whole tells a story about the region. What's that story?
Well, one of the things, if you look at it over a period of 20 years, we're losing enrollment, we're losing population, and the economic growth is on a downward spiral. And it's alarming if you see the number and the percentage of students or families that are living in poverty within the region of Eastern Kentucky versus some of the other regions in the state. It's quite alarming. And one of the things that I took from the paper and the statistics was that we can't continue this spiral. We've got to do something, and if it takes the school systems working with the local officials and the state officials to come together, then that's what we have to do. Someone has to pick up the iron and start. And for me, it's KVEC was part of that process of getting it started with the local, the other 22 districts involved, and the superintendents had a big role, but also Jeff and his staff played a big part in this. But it gives us something to go out, a tool to go out and speak with these officials. Look, we've got the data. We're looking around the bend. Now where do we go? But one of the things that I've noticed, the thing that this has done is opened up communication in a small community like McGoffin County. Now we're having talks with the mayors and the county judge and the city council and the magistrate. And it's not on political issues or anything like that. It's about how can we help each other. And that's a big change over the last year or so that I've been in the system 31 years. And not that we didn't have relationships with those people in the past, but the difference in our talk is how are we helping each other. We've actually had a meeting a few months back at KVEC where Jeff invited the local officials with the superintendents of the district, and I was able to bring the magistrate, the state representative, and our county judge, all of them rode up with me to the meeting. That may have not happened 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You would ask what story the trend data in the report tells.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the most profound story it tells is that we in our region are incredible experts at exporting our wealth. For years, we cut down every tree that was suitable for timber and we shipped it somewhere else. Then we dug coal out from under the ground and we shipped it somewhere else. Most recently, we've drilled holes in the ground to get natural gas that we put in a pipeline and send it somewhere else. But throughout that remarkable history, we have exported our most important resource, our young people. They have went to other communities and helped those communities to thrive because there was a diversification of opportunity there and employment that made it possible for them to do that. So the trend data in the report that we presented really demonstrates our expertise at preparing people to be creative, to be problem solvers, to be hard workers, and to go somewhere else and help that community improve. So what we want to do is flip that script and reverse it so that the brain drain is no longer ongoing, but to be able to create a diversity of employment opportunities where we are and take advantage of the assets that we have. And in the report, we also offer some opportunities. We call them considerations, one of which is specifically related to the K-12 environment, and that is to create an equity assessment to determine whether a school or a district has the resources to provide an equitable opportunity for all learners within that school or district. If we can do that for sports teams in Title IX to tell the difference between male and female athletes, we ought to be able to do that for the academics of children. Another element that we put forth is to create a regional futuring committee, a group of people from every walk of life who can come together and examine what the future could be, built on abundance and not on scarcity. Not to talk about what we don't have, but what do we have that we can build on and grow. An element of that is to create the first rural educonomy zone in the country. We believe that if we can help people understand the close connection between education and economic development, that will allow us to open up resources that need to be available in order to build the future as we go forward. Another consideration that we offer is to boldly declare that Kentucky will be a top 10 academic state within 10 years. Kara is now 30 years old, and it's time we think that we re-examine our commitment to public education and our commitment as a state. And there are lots of organizations across the state who are committed to education, and we want to work, obviously, with them in support of what they do. But we need to focus on how do we make that happen in our region. And I hope that listeners will look at this report and look at the trend data as it's laid out.
To reach that future that you're laying out there, there's some ingrained things that need to be overcome. And one of them is called for in the report. It calls for continued systemic change to overcome historical barriers. What sorts of changes are needed?
Openness. We need to help folks realize that we are collectively smarter and more able together than we are when we are siloed and separate. And that means that we have to be able to pay attention to younger generations of folks. We have to understand that everyone has a vested interest in building the future, and how we can have a school system be able to work with a local county government or a city government, the civic organizations that are there, higher education, early childhood. All of those entities need to come together in order to be able to figure out what that way forward will look like.
Do you all think that in today's highly polarized and very toxic political atmosphere and environment that we're in, can the politics that so often get in the way of collaboration be overcome?
We try to stay out of that. We're going to focus on what we see, what's going on within our communities, in our region. If you look at the data, 10 years ago, if I had a teaching position open up in an elementary position, I would have 20 to 25 applications for that elementary teaching position. Now I may get two or three. And that's becoming concerning to us. And, you know, we've always had a problem finding certain certifications, but now it's becoming a broader aspect across the curriculum and trying to find the grade levels teachers to come back home and work. And one of the things is there's misconception out there that all teachers are paid the same across the state. That's not true. our schools in Eastern Kentucky typically play less than some of the Central and Northern Kentucky school districts do. So it's challenging to bring those kids when they graduate, unless they want to come back home for certain reasons. It's hard for them to come home, like Jeff said. We've got to change that to where they can come home, or if they've got a spouse that doesn't teach or doesn't work, but we're able to offer that person a position or a job in our community that they can be able to stay home and come back to the region and work. Right now, it's hard for us to do that. So it's becoming challenging just recruiting teachers and keeping that positive vibe and providing the appropriate education that we need to for our children.
Well, you mentioned positive vibe, and one of the hottest flashpoints in Kentucky politics today revolves around our public school teachers, and questions about assessment and accountability have been raised, and this report raises some as well. What in this area is needed to support and preserve the credibility of our system of public education? Jeff?
I think for us, where we are, when it comes to assessment and accountability, it's really critical for all of us to understand the difference between assessment and accountability. We lump those two together. And assessment is the way that we measure how much students have learned or what they're able to do. It measures their progress during a period of time. Accountability is how we hold a school accountable that they have done their job. We are using an academic measure as an accountability measure to grade out a school and its ability to move students from one level to the next. In this report, there are a couple of areas that we really touch on that model since it began in 1990, basically, that high-stakes accountability model driven by an assessment that has changed over 200 times since its beginning. In one grade level, in the fourth grade, the assessment for students has changed 36 or 37 times. It's changed more than there have been years that it's been affected by. Mm-hmm. What we are working to do is to change the way that we instruct students so that they can demonstrate their learning and show the progress that they've made in the current assessment structures that we have, which are basically paper and pencil tests, but also do that so that those kids are engaged in long-term problem solving that is aimed at community or entrepreneurialism or being able to overcome a challenge that is pervasive in real life and exists. We believe that by moving beyond the importance of the test only being the score, that the importance becomes larger than that test assessment. It is bringing potable water to a distant community or figuring out an entrepreneurial design to be able to build drones that can then be launched and map a particular area or look for wildfire or gauge the water density in a forest. Those allow students to demonstrate knowledge toward a pervasive problem that needs to be solved and also learn the skills that are necessary in order to be successful on the assessment that will drive the accountability score.
What do you think might happen in the 2020 General Assembly?
I think what we wanted to do, we released this on February the 12th during this short legislative session this year, knowing that it was a short session, not a budget year, and that it was midway through the session, understanding that we would probably not get any legislative interest in advancing any of the ideas here because folks need to really stew on it. They need to think about it. They need to figure out how it's going to work. So we released it this year with the intent that during the period between sessions, we would continue to put this in front of people. We would continue to have dialogue and discussion in hopes that during this coming legislative session, the long session, it would attract enough traction for people to get interested and begin to have this as a conversation point as we do move forward into the new year.
Magoffin County Public Schools Superintendent Scott Helton and Jeff Hawkins, Director of the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Been a pleasure.
And again, the report, A Way Forward, can be found online at theholler.org. Coming up after the break, that search for ways to plug the brain drain.
How do we figure out how people who live here now can thrive where they live as opposed to having to go elsewhere in order to find means to an end?
Brent Hutchinson of the Hindman Settlement School on what he hopes to bring back to the region as he begins 2 years as an Obama Foundation Fellow. Chris Begley begins an ongoing series about survival in the great outdoors and a project to bring the Great Lakes to Kentucky, so to speak. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We recently reported here on Eastern Standard that the annual report of the Appalachian Regional Commission, or ARC, listed most of eastern Kentucky's counties as distressed or at risk of becoming distressed. Employment in the region has continued to decline. The mining industry continues to suffer losses. Revelation Energy and its affiliate Black Jewel recently filed for bankruptcy, and that could affect more than 1,000 jobs in Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia. Sykes in Perry County just announced layoffs beginning in September, and that'll affect 179 employees. The company employs people from many counties, so the impact will be felt through a larger area. One local official within ARC's territory talked about it with WEKU's Stu Johnson at a gathering of county officials in Lexington. He believes selective regionalism could benefit the area. His county, Cumberland, is listed as at risk of becoming distressed. County Judge John Phelps says the biggest challenge remains employment.
Jobs, we need to do more to create more jobs, and at the same time, we've got to continue to develop a better workforce to attract those jobs. So, I mean, it's we've got leaps and bounds that we've got to do to create a better environment for our people.
Phelps says counties still want to maintain some autonomy, but joining up may work in selected cases.
I think regionally, a large corporation, I think it's something that, multiple counties could work together on together. Something that's centralized, and then, the things that may develop off that, spinoff companies, pods that may come off that, and then, set up shop in surrounding counties. So, I think there's benefits to both.
Phelps says there's been increased communication between secondary schools and technical schools. He says that can help usher students into technical jobs when that's appropriate. Phelps says regional cooperation with multiple counties can work, especially if the aim is to lure a large corporation to Appalachia. This spring, Brent Hutchinson, executive director of the Hindman Settlement School, learned that he had been chosen for an Obama Foundation Fellowship, joining 19 other community-minded rising stars from all around the world for a 2-year program that's designed to inspire a wave of civic innovation. So Dr. Hutchinson, a native of Eastern Kentucky and a Morehead State University graduate, is now trading insights and ideas with leaders representing 10 countries and 5 continents, all searching for solutions to many of the world's most pressing problems, problems like those that we see faced by the people of Appalachian Kentucky. He joins us from a studio at WMMT at Apple Shop in Whitesburg. Thanks for joining us, Brent, and congratulations on your selection as an Obama Fellow.
Thanks so much, Tom.
So the first Fellows Gathering, as I understand it, was in D.C. in May. Tell us about that and maybe some takeaways.
Sure. The Fellows gathered in Washington, D.C. For 5 days, and we actually gathered alongside the first cohort, which was named last year. And it was 5 days of getting to know the Obama Foundation, what our responsibilities, honestly, would be as fellows, but also the opportunities that were being laid out before us. And so we spent the majority of that time getting to know one another, trying to unpack a little bit about why we are in that room as opposed to the 5,000 other people that it could have been, and really trying to figure out from there where we go from here, what we all kind of collectively are able to harness toward this wave, as they call a wave of civic innovation.
So a release about your selection says Obama Foundation Fellows, quote, tackle big, complex issues in unique and inspiring ways. What sorts of issues are you taking to the table?
Well, I can tell you from a couple of different perspectives, what they say about the work we're doing at Hyman Settlement School is that we are approaching the issues we face in Eastern Kentucky from a holistic perspective and a community-based perspective in an effort to help people thrive where they live. And that's something, honestly, that I've talked about since I began my tenure at Hyman Settlement School 7 years ago. We live in changing, rapidly changing times with multiple challenges that are incredibly complex, that are not just things that have been created and dropped on us recently, but things that we've been facing really for decades, for generations, honestly. And how do we figure out how people who live here now can thrive where they live as opposed to having to go elsewhere in order to find means to an end, you know, an income that supports their lifestyle or appropriate education or healthcare or whatever it might be? How can we augment life here in such a way that if people want to be here, they don't have to look elsewhere? You know, smart people stay here and work here. We have creative ideas that are our own and that don't come from the outside. Those are the types of things that we've been thinking about for a while. And so the fellowship in many ways is a recognition of that effort.
And so that goes to what has been identified as a really serious problem for the region, and that is depopulation.
Yeah, significant population. We have an out-migration that's not slowing down.
A huge advantage that cities have over rural communities is enormous local consumer bases. For rural communities in places like Eastern Kentucky, the local consumer base is a lot thinner, and so there's only so much demand that can be pulled out of it. So how, in light of that, can rural communities survive, much less thrive?
That's a great question. Rural communities have survived for generations with very little. And so when we think about how we are using the resources that we have to move ourselves forward, you know, we have to be able to look at ourselves internally first to realize what we do have, with that we don't take our resources elsewhere, that we support things like local business and local efforts. But honestly, too, we have to be able to come together and say, you know, we want to define who we are. And so when we go outside, obviously we learn new things that are important to bring back home, but we can't do that to the degree that we allow other people to define what our legacy is going to look like and be. And so I think in many ways we've done that. You know, cities have much to offer. Rural places do too. And leaders in rural places certainly can't deny the ingenuity and the passion and the power that people in our locales actually possess.
We know that employment in the coal industry is now down to 0.6% of Kentucky's overall jobs picture. What other industries might return some prosperity to the region? Is there clarity about that, or do we just really not know?
That's a good question, too. I think that we're beginning to know. You know, what we know is that when coal jobs leave communities, about 7 other jobs also leave communities. So it's not just about coal. We know that there's a residual kind of a ripple effect because of it. When I moved to Knott County in 2012, that was the same year that the last underground mine had closed there. And so I've seen what that's looked like in my time there and know that it's not just about coal jobs that are leaving. It's about people who are seeking opportunities elsewhere to try to figure out how they not only sustain their families, but give their kids opportunities to grow and thrive. And in order for that to change where we are, I think we, number one, have to look at the assets we have. And so in a place like Eastern Kentucky, that's as beautiful and hospitable as anywhere in the world, and I've had the opportunity to travel quite a bit, you know, we have the opportunity to draw people here from a tourism perspective, which I think matters. But we also have a lot going on outside of that. We know that local food and the local food movement is something that a lot of people around the country think is kind of cool, and they love going to the restaurants that are farm to table. We've done farm to table our whole existence, and it's something that has sustained us in very rich ways. I think it was now almost 2 years ago that Ronnie Lundy won the James Beard Award for her cookbook Vittles, which began to outline just the truth of Appalachian food and cooking and what that means for us. And that was a whole lot more than just a cookbook. And so we believe that at Hindman in particular, that local food and that movement is critical to helping people thrive where they live and not be taken advantage from the outside of high food prices and low food quality. We know that if we can maintain that where we are, that's big. You know, the broadband initiative that Congressman Rogers has really led the way on for us is one that could be a potential game changer in terms of opening up a global marketplace. And so we're following that closely. If people are able to stay here and be entrepreneurial and creative and start a business that can thrive from their home in Eastern Kentucky, that's a big deal for everybody in their community. And then on top of that, we've got an aging population that continues to have needs that can be met through innovative approaches to things like healthcare. And so there's really not one answer, in my opinion, for what a new economy in this new Appalachia looks like. It's a multifaceted answer that requires us working together and being creative together and thinking outside the box. There are probably things we can learn from the outside, but the answers are going to have to come from within, and they're going to be specifically, I think, derived from the people who are here who get it the most.
Any other big reforms that you see out there that need to take place before these things can be realized?
I'm not sure if I would say that I have a sense of what big reforms there could be, but I think one of the things that's true is that people who have a vested interest in the region have to stay in the region and work for its good for long periods of time. You know, social change does not take place quickly. It takes place over time. And so people who are working hard now with big ideas and fresh ideas and really good ideas, I think need to stick with them. And I think they need to see them through. And I think more than anything, have to learn how to work together in a way that maybe they never have. You know, we tend to be fairly divided as a society right now, let alone in our local communities. From one county to the next, you've got a 20-minute drive, but a completely different identity and a strong sense of what that place means and how it's different from what my place means. And there's something about that that's important and special, but at the same time, in order for us to move forward, we have to think a little bit larger than what it might mean for Knott County or Letcher County or where I grew up in Lawrence County. We might have to think regionally, and we might have to think across communities, and that's not something that we've done incredibly well for a long period of time. I think that movement in that direction, the ability to lock arms with one another with common goals and trying to move past the divisiveness of things like politics or economy, you know, the economic divide that we face, those are things that we're going to have to embrace in order for us to be able to move forward.
Well, we're going through a period of transition, of transformation, of experimentation, of uncertainty. And all of those things imply change, which is difficult for people to wrap their arms around. But it may be necessary right now. Do you think that we're just going to have to be comfortable with throwing a lot of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks?
Maybe to some degree. One of my college professors said the only thing that you can ever predict is that things are going to change. And so for us to be reticent to change is really a losing cause. I mean, we have to understand that things do change and that we have an opportunity to really create that change for ourselves. I think if we fear change, what we're really fearing is the ability to control. And that often comes, at least in Eastern Kentucky, from the outside. We can't control what comes from the outside toward us. But if we are able to step into these gaps ourselves and be able to articulate what we want to allow in and what ideas we want to allow out and how we can begin to really communicate in a way that puts us on the same page, you know, we begin to control that change, not in a way that's heavy-handed, but in a way that is informed. I think that's really the right approach. And so, yeah, are there going to be experiments? For sure. There have to be. But at the same time, we know what we do well, I think, as a people. And I think we see our region for what it is. We have a pretty honest sense of who we are and what we are. And so if we're able to kind of dig in together and if people are able to articulate a way forward, I think other people will follow.
Brent Hutchinson is Executive Director of the Hindman Settlement School and an Obama Foundation Fellow, and he joins us from WMMT at Apple Shop in Whitesburg. Thanks so much, Brent.
Thanks, Tom.
Let's check in with Christine Huskisson of our arts and culture partner, Undermain, about a project now underway.
Undermain is excited to be diving into new territory this summer. We've sent a Kentucky artist out on assignment. Photographer and UK faculty member James Southard is with us today to discuss his three-week-long tour of the Great Lakes region. But before I introduce him, I should say that his adventures are funded in part by the Great Meadows Foundation and are intended to learn more about how artists live and work in the urban areas around Milwaukee and Chicago, around Thunder Bay and Duluth, and the Rust Belt of Cleveland and Detroit. James has set an ambitious itinerary of meeting 27 artists, curators, and craftsmen in 12 different cities over a period of 3 weeks. How's it going, James?
It's going great.
Tell us where you are.
Right now, I am in the farmland of southern Ontario, in between Lake Huron and Toronto. So dead center of the peninsula down there.
For you, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your journeys. I don't want you to tell too much, though, because we do have a 5-part photo essay series coming up that will be published on Undermain at the end of July. But maybe tell us a little bit about some of the people that you've met.
Sure, yeah. I've met a bunch of different kinds of visual artists and some curators and even a musician or two. And just trying to get to understand how creatives are working and living in the area.
Yeah, I know you've met a number of different people from various places. And one of the most interesting, I think, for us is Thunder Bay. Tell us a little bit about that place.
Yeah, Thunder Bay is interesting. I didn't realize how far north it was until I arrived. It's way up there in northern Ontario. It's an industrial city. It's the farthest, the westernmost port in the Great Lakes. And there's a huge, what they call First Nation presence there, which we would call Native American. So when you're there, there's a lot of Native American art and museums, and you find it in the galleries. And I happened to just luckily be there during a National First Nation celebration. It's a Canadian holiday, and I was there for powwows. I got to see a lot of traditional dance and meeting a few artists while I was up there, too.
Tell us a little bit about how you're photographing.
When I'm photographing them, it's funny. I have some years as my training was as a photojournalist when I was an undergrad at University of Louisville, before I went back to school to study contemporary art. But my gut instinct is to try to get a picture of someone in their environment or someone in front of their work or someone explaining their work. So I'm always keeping my camera on my hip when I'm interviewing someone, and people keep commenting. They're like, why aren't you taking notes? And I'm like, I have to memorize it. And I want to keep my camera in my hand, not a notepad and pen. So I'm always kind of snapping away. And only when we're finishing an interview and I stood in front of something while they were telling me about it, then I may ask them, hey, can we go back to that spot we were, and can you stand in front of it? So usually when you see someone posing for me, it's because they literally were sitting there talking to me about their work or about living in this community. And I just saw something and I just took a note that I wanted to come back. And sometimes it's off the cuff. I just snapped the camera and that was what's standing in front of me. So even today, I shot a lot of work out in Lake Huron. I got a boat ride out to visit some craftsmen that were working on the a lighthouse in Southampton. And I was snapping away like can be with the waves, rocking the boat around. Most difficult photo shoot, I'd say, of the whole trip so far.
What else do you want to tell us now today about what you might bring back to the conversation in Kentucky about your travels?
You know, I'd always felt that Southern hospitality was, you know, I was thinking about how much in Kentucky we just considered a Southern thing. Like, oh, we're just so friendly here. And if you need help with anything, we always step up and help each other, especially in the art world where, you know, we're a small community where we know each other. So if you need material or you need a venue or what have you, you just reach out to a few people, you can make it happen. And I realize that's the same case up here in northern Ontario. And as I'm entering southern Ontario, I'm starting to experience the same thing. So I'm starting to realize, like, you know what? Actually, the arts communities are everywhere more similar than I thought. Because everywhere I've been, I've met the friendliest people that have asked me, you know, like, oh, you know, I just met you 10 minutes ago. Where are you going next? Oh, I know 3 people, or I know a cabin you can stay in, or I know the material that you can use for that photograph. Let me just make some calls. And I'm trying to be polite and say, no, that's okay. Don't worry about it. Or where should I pay? Or like, no, your money's no good. Like, that's happened more often than not. And it's been really impressive. And it reminds me very much of home in central Kentucky. Makes making art so much easier, I feel, when everyone is supportive and no one's trying to put their guard up because some artist is in front of them.
Tell us a little bit more, too, about the funding that you received from Great Meadows. Just briefly touch on that, if you will.
Sure. The Great Meadows Foundation is a very generous, privately funded grant by Al Shands. And what it does, it supports Kentucky artists and now curators to get outside of the state and visit other communities and see work. So people have used it to fund to go to the Venice Biennial in Italy or Documenta in Germany or go all the way to Tokyo to see a sculpture show. The way I've always wanted to push is, you know, there's so much in North America I've not seen. So I've always used the grant to just get to all the corners of this country and America as well to find out how people are working and living, which I think is one of the biggest questions that, as an American artist, I want to know how all of us are surviving. So Great Meadows has always been so supportive of that.
Wonderful. Yeah, we all look forward to seeing what you bring back to us, James. Safe travels as you enter Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. And for those of you listening today, please watch for James's 5-part photo essay series. It will begin mid to late July. Is that correct, James?
Yes, yes.
And hopefully we'll run them through the end of August. Thanks again, James, and safe travels.
Thank you. Talk to you guys later.
It's not unusual, especially in the summertime, to hear about search and rescue operations in places like the backcountry of the Red River Gorge or other remote areas of Kentucky. What about those situations where you can't count on a rescue? We're joined by archaeologist and wilderness survival instructor Chris Begley for the first in a series about things we need to know to stay safe when venturing into the great outdoors. Chris has learned, applied, and taught survival skills in many different areas, among them tropical rainforests, alpine areas, and, of course, right here in Kentucky. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
So, Chris, let's begin with, in what sorts of situations would you need to fend for yourself?
Well, here you can almost always count on search and rescue teams, but that relies on you having done certain things so that people know where to look for you. For instance, if you've not told anyone where you're going, it's going to be hard for them to know where to look for you. Or it could be an unexpected event, a car crash or a plane wreck or something of that sort. And those, I think, are the typical situations where you would need to find your own way home.
Are there some important basic skills that allow you to survive out there?
Yeah, there certainly are. When I teach survival courses, I tend to think of it in those terms as a decision-making process. And this allows you to apply sort of this knowledge to any particular situation. Now, some of the fundamental skills include how to protect yourself from the elements, particularly temperature, cold temperatures, how to find and purify water, what to do about food, and how to find other people so you can get home.
Okay, those are some of the basic decisions you'll have to make. Let's expand on those a little bit. What can you tell us?
Well, your first question might depend on where and how you find yourself in this situation. Were you lost hiking? Have you been in a car wreck? Have you been in a plane crash? These series of questions would start with the most immediate concerns. For instance, I would start by asking, am I safe where I am? Do I need to get out of a plane or this car? I'm in an area where there might be flash floods or avalanches. You might need to get away from your location immediately. The next set of questions would probably involve medical issues. Am I hurt? How badly? What do I need to do to survive my injuries? Am I mobile? Can I walk? Do I need to stop bleeding or splint a broken bone? After that, I think I would look at the elements. Am I at risk of hypothermia or overheating? What can I do to minimize that risk? Water would come next. Do I have any? Can I get some? And how do I make it safe to drink?
What about food? It might seem you're out there in the forest and it looks like there's an abundance of things that you might eat, but is that so?
Well, there might be an abundance of things that you can eat, but it really requires the knowledge to pick the right things. Food is not going to be nearly as important as we think it is and as we often talk about it. You're not going to be gone long enough in most of these scenarios to need food, and you certainly don't want to make it worse by eating something that's toxic. Of all the plant species in North America, over half are toxic to humans during some part of their life cycle. Animals and insects are mostly edible, but they require time and energy to collect, and you really have a couple of weeks before food becomes a real concern.
What if you are genuinely lost out there and you've lost your orientation? We know, of course, the sun comes up in the east, goes down in the west, so we have that going for us. But what are some other general rules?
Well, there are many different ways to ultimately find your way back. One is to do what you would need to do to find other people. And that can often be as simple as finding a waterway, a creek, and follow it downstream to the bigger waterway down to the river, and you'll always find people. in that way. If you find a road or a trail that's going to lead to people. And then there are many ways in which you can tell the direction. Of course, sun comes up in the east, sets in the west. But we can also, from the sun, if we know what time of day it is, tell which way is north and south. We can do that by looking at the stars, of course. We can do it by looking at the moon. We can do it by looking at plants in some cases.
I've heard in the Australian outback, for example, if you're lost out there and you're lucky enough to come upon an anthill, of course, you know, there are those giant anthills, that they are always oriented facing north. So you can tell by looking at one of those which way is north. Are there any natural markers that we might look for in this area?
No, absolutely. We've all heard that moss grows on the north side of trees, and that is true to some degree. There are plants that like the cold, the dark, the wetter areas. Rhododendron or mountain laurel in the gorge, for instance, will typically be in the north or west-facing hollers. You might find some of the weather patterns also affecting the way in which plants look. We have prevailing winds from the west. Plants tend to be bent by that wind, and over time, those are sort of permanent features of some of those plants. Or even the fact that the sun is in the southern part of the sky here, you'll see plants growing more robustly in that direction.
So we're heading out there. We know we're going to be out in a wilderness area and maybe totally alone. What essentials do we need to be absolutely certain we have along with us?
Well, probably the most basic thing would be clothing that's appropriate for the weather and the weather that you might encounter if you're out there longer than you think you will be. Most deaths from hypothermia, for instance, happen in situations where it's sunny and warm during the day, maybe in the 50s and you're hiking with a t-shirt. You get lost, you end up out there at night when the temperature drops into the 30s. Those are the kinds of dangerous situations you might find yourself in. Or you're not dressed appropriately for the weather because you think you're going to be in your car for the entire trip, and then something happens where you have to leave your vehicle. So that would be the first one. The other two things that I would always want to have is some way to start a fire and a knife or some cutting tool.
Well, this is just the beginning of what will be, we think, a really interesting series on how to get by out there in the wilderness. That's archaeologist and wilderness survival instructor Chris Begley. He'll be here on Eastern Standard from time to time offering tips on how to get out there and safely enjoy nature and the environment. Thanks a lot, Chris.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And all current and previous editions of Eastern Standard are available online at esweku.com. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.